We had a lively interest in whatever the administration was doing with respect to church and state.
This is something that we fought hard for.
Religious liberty is one of the hallmarks and part of the bedrock of American democracy.
We at the BJC like to say when anyone's religious liberty is threatened, everyone's religious liberty is at risk. Welcome to the BJC podcast. I'm Amanda Tyler, the Executive Director of the Baptist Joint Committee. Today I'm here with Dr. Molly Marshall, President of Central Baptist Theological Seminary, while we're here visiting her campus in the Kansas City area. Molly, thanks for joining us today.
It's a joy. Thank you.
So, Molly, you've been president here at Central in Shawnee, Kansas, right outside of Kansas City, for the past 15 years. You've spent most of your career in theological education. Why is theological education so important to you?
It is that opportunity to shape the church. And it's the opportunity to provide formation for ministers, to open up for them a love of God, a way to seek God, a way then to be a reliable guide as they come alongside the folk that they lead. And because I believe seminaries are one of the few places where the intellectual heritage of the faith is discussed and protracted, theological education claims my heart in a deep way.
And you spent most of your career in this setting, but 15 years ago you really moved from the classroom to the administration. And I imagine that has been a learning experience in its own right for you.
Well, I knew how to administer a syllabus. I'm not sure I knew how to administer a budget. Actually, I've continued to teach the whole time I've been president, primarily now in Doctor of Ministry seminars. It was a major shift to come to a troubled school. I knew the school. I'd been here 9 years. Prior to that, I'd taught a dozen years in Louisville. The challenges were many, and so I had to learn a new skill set. I became a student of the office of the president. I had never raised money except for car washes when I was a youth minister. And so learning how to appeal to people who would care about the mission of the school was job one, because we were very fragile. One of the board members said we threw her the keys to the Titanic, and he wasn't kidding, because it was very fragile. But I've had very good partnerships with board chairs. I've had a wonderful partnership with our executive vice president. We've been joined at the hip the whole time I've been doing this. And so our work, our collegiality, and our deeply grounded faith that God had a significant mission for Central to pursue has kept us going.
Yeah.
And so at first it was about recovery, and then it was about reconfiguring our mission. And now in this summative time is about sustainability. Where do we go? How will we continue to move the institution forward?
And regardless of the institution, you came to the school at a time of a tremendous challenge for all of theological education. And being here on the campus, I can see that you have done much more than keep this place afloat, that you're really sailing smoothly, you know, at this point. And you've identified some of the relationship, some of your connection with where God was calling the seminary. But what else do you really ascribe this tremendous success to that you've had here?
We have placed students at the very center of our mission. So we teach not when professors want to teach, but when students can take these classes, nights, weekends, intensives, and accessibly. So we've moved to a significant virtual footprint, even though we can have students in a class as well as on the screen at the same time, which is a good hybrid model. We have been very intent on serving those folk who were overlooked in other contexts. We have a large Korean constituency, and they prefer to do graduate theological studies in Korean, which means we've had to branch out in terms of finding an instructional force to cover that. We've also become the seminary of choice for the Burma diaspora. We have an increasing number of students who have now immigrated to the U.S. from Myanmar. They call it the Burma diaspora. And we have done what is helpful in terms of deep tuition discounting, English, enhanced English linguistic skills. We are trying to make it possible for them to flourish. Part of this arises out of over a decade-long partnership with the premier Baptist theological school in Myanmar, Myanmar Institute of Theology, which has been there since 1927. We first became acquainted with them in the 50s, before my time, I might add, when, after the destructions by the Japanese of much of Burma, they approached Central after World War II in the early 50s and said, could you help us? And so from about 55 to 61, we oversaw their accreditation, and the degrees granted there were from Central. Even today, and this is delightful, when I go there, some of the older pastors, they may be in their 80s, will come and show me their old crinkled up diploma, and they will say, I just wanted to meet my president. Oh. Now that moves me and catches my heart deeply. And then they got back on their feet. And then in 2007, we hosted a big gathering, a mission conference, sponsored by American Baptist Churches here on our campus. And the principal, Dr. Simon PKN of MIT, was here. And he said, could we renew a historic partnership? And I thought, I'd love to. We are in so frail financially. I wasn't sure how we could. 2 months later, I was at a development professionals meeting, and I heard Michael Gilligan of the Luce Foundation talk about his foundation's desire always to do something in Myanmar, particularly Myanmar Institute of Theology, but didn't have a way to do it. He said, amen, and I was in his face. I can help you with that, Michael. And so for the last 10 years, the Luce Foundation has underwritten to a major degree this partnering work that we do. And we just got a grant renewal for 3 more years. We go there once a year. They come here once a year. Faculty development, cultural immersion experiences, looking at how the gospel takes root in a culture where Christians are a religious minority. When I did the Sheridan Lectures just a few years ago, I did it through the lens of Myanmar, how to think about religious liberty in that context.
And I'm so grateful for so much of what you just said. I mean, one, just telling that story and being connected to the history in such a way, but then reinventing something that fits in everyone's modern context, and also giving such a gift to that generous friend and donor who wanted to do something, and you were able to be the vehicle for that. And you did mention your delivery of the Sheridan Lectures just a couple of years ago, and our listeners can go back and listen to those excellent lectures. I will admit I listened to those lectures as I was preparing for my interviews with the Baptist Joint Committee, and was so touched with your way to internationalize our look at religious liberty. Yeah. You know, so much of our work at BJC over our past eight decades has been in our American context. But we live in a global society, of course, and we can learn so much about religious liberty and religion from our brothers and sisters around the world.
Well, the Baptist link is very long. They know Roger Williams in Myanmar. Adoniram Judson and Ann Judson made sure of that. So it's an interesting connection. You know that growth in most American Baptist churches, the growth is coming because of the Burma diaspora. And so last year, 0.03%, according to the Pew Foundation, I know where that growth comes. And so our school has been intentionally global in its outreach, which makes for better education for the American students to have this concourse, this interface with colleagues from around the world.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm speaking a lot right now about Christian nationalism.
Yes.
Because of the really rise, I think, of that ideology in the country now. And one of the things we have to be reminded is that American citizenship and citizenship in the kingdom of God are not the same, right? And to state the obvious, not all Christians are Americans. Not all Americans are Christians.
Correct.
And I think, you know, I spend a lot more time on the not all Americans are Christians side of things, but I wonder just what's your reflection on the idea of not all Christians are Americans? How can we deepen in our faith with more of an international look?
We can deepen in our faith because the religion is not privileged. It's not protected. In fact, it's marginalized in very deliberate ways, particularly in Myanmar. And so if you are a religious minority and do not claim the kind of hegemonic privilege, then there's a distilling of what matters in your faith. And there is a courage required to try to jump through the hoops you have to even to get a permit to build a church. And so the church state divide, and yet the requirement that one appeal to a government that is negatively disposed toward your faith and tries to control its growth requires a great deal of courage. It also requires for Christians to be prophetic, perhaps in ways we have forgotten how to be. The collusion of a government with poppy growers, with bribes, with displacement of ethnic peoples really requires a depth of hope and resilience and really belief in the resurrecting power of the gospel, and perhaps have a more refined eschatology than some of us. Some of my theologian friends said, if you live in North Dallas, you don't need to think about heaven. Actually, I had a student here from Chin State, Zakhar, as we were riding through an affluent section of Kansas City, said, "You all don't have to think much about heaven here, do you?" Hmm. Once again, a very moving statement.
Yeah.
So there's a theological depth. There's also a humility. If you live in a religiously plural context, you realize that other ways of faith have a legitimate claim on the human heart and can offer a pathway. And so one of the things that we have learned as an institution through our far-flung enterprise is to cultivate respect for the lived religion of others, which I think is a critical piece right now, given the kind of silliness that we hear trumpeted out of many of our political leaders these days. I want people to claim faith that is personal and that is authentic, but I don't want it to fill up all the space as if there is not room for other persuaded, convictional pathways. Mm. And so I say that as a confessing Christian who believes that the Spirit of God is at work across the many ways of faith, and in God's mercy, the sorting out occurs in a way that transcends our comprehension.
I just love that. I jotted it down just now, that we must cultivate respect for the lived religion of others. And I'm so pleased you touched on that virtue of humility, which is so missing, I think, in our conversations in our society now, and how a deeper connection with Christians around the world can help us cultivate that virtue as well. Well, what brings us together to have this wonderful conversation today is the 2019 Sheridan Lectures. We are hearing from the Reverend Dr. Aidsan Wright Riggins this evening in a really provocative lecture. And, you know, shortly after you delivered the lectures for BJC in 2016, we started having a conversation about bringing these lectures to Central. And why was that so important to you that we bring the Sheridan Lectures here?
Well, I love the BJC. And you just saw James Dunn suspenders in my office.
I did.
And James has been on our campus. And so I've known of the BJC all of my more mature years, and so value the voice that it is. And I want seminarians and the larger community to understand how valuable conversations about religious liberty are in a time where there's an encroachment on that reality. I wanted Central to host the lectures because I wanted to honor the work of the Sheridans, who are my friends. I wanted to move the geographical footprint a bit to the west. We are a historic American Baptist school, but we have deep ties as well with CBF, National Baptist, etc. And I thought this would be a good meeting place for a family reunion of lots of kinds of Baptists. And I also want both the exposure to BJC, but also I want you all to know that there's a theological school that is doing some things that enhances the larger public mission. We don't just think we're preparing leaders to serve in congregations. We believe we're preparing leaders to do the kind of work on the social landscape that requires the sensibilities about religious liberty and respect for the religion of others, and that is a deep cry for justice. So having Aidsan here with our intentional commitment to diversity matters to me a great deal. And I'm delighted that he is rather unbound in what he is willing to say about the state of race and religion and religious liberty in our time.
And, you know, our country has been having this national reckoning with the sins of racism and slavery. But, you know, even when we were planning this, I think we didn't even know, you know, how timely this conversation would be for the community. So we're so grateful for the hosting.
Well, thank you for that. BJC is in some ways a David in the Goliaths, and Central is that also, even though we have grown, given how well-resourced certain schools are that are embedded in universities. And so our faith mission, if you please, is a deep expression in the provision and the providence of God to sustain our work. And I know that that is what BJC does.
Absolutely.
Month by month. And so when you form good partnerships, and we've sent an intern to you along the way. When you form good partnerships with people of like mind and pursuit, then good things happen, and the synergy really enhances the mission of the two entities.
And like David, I like to think BJC and Central are small but very mighty.
I believe so. I believe so.
So we are also here during the month of March, which of course is Women's History Month. You have been such a trailblazer for women in Baptist life. You've been a mentor to me over these last 2 years in leadership. What has your journey been like? I know we don't have the kind of time to really hear that story, but would like to hear that, and also what changes you've seen now as compared to when you began in your career in ministry.
Well, I'm glad you gave a time limitation. When you're old, you have lots to recount. Yesterday, I was writing a piece for Baptist World Alliance that I will give this July, and they gave me the huge topic, women in ministry, and I thought, now that's too much fun. So I talked about the charism of women in ministry, and I'll talk more about that if you want. But I recounted my first ministry position, and I looked at what a summer that was, and then it scared me. It was 50 years ago. In 1969, I was a 19-year-old doing summer youth ministry through the Southern Baptist Home Mission Board in Baltimore, Maryland. What this journey has been like for me is a relentless resolve to be willing to risk, to try something that no one had seen before and folks were skeptical of, but to go do it out of a deep passion for the work, love of God, love of adolescents, love of seminarians, love of congregations. And so it's a joyful work, but it's also had its obstacles, as you might imagine. When I graduated from seminary in 1973, I was one of only three women in my Master of Divinity class of about 800 people. And so it's kind of like the early, well, things have shifted in law, but it was not until the early 70s that there was kind of an increment of women coming into the non-traditional fields, not music, not children's ministry, not Christian ed. I had to talk my way into the School of Theology. They automatically enrolled me in the School of Religious Education. And then I enrolled in all theology and language and biblical courses and went and told the dean what I'd done and asked for a transfer to the School of Theology under a bit of protest from him. I remember often being the only woman in a class, and a big old strapping fellow would say, "Little lady." Well, when they start with little lady, you know you're in trouble. "What are you doing in here with all us fellas?" "Well, I'm here to get your church, buddy," is basically what I would say. And so it didn't hurt that I grew up between brothers and had a well-honed sense of competition from early on. My years teaching in Louisville were blessed and yet freighted with much suspicion, because I began PhD studies the very fall that the first flowering of the hostile takeover, or conservative resurgence, if you talk about it through another lens, began to transpire among Southern Baptists. And the next 11 years, when I began to teach in 83, they were fraught with suspicion that I was not trustworthy to teach. And because I was bringing a different sensibility to it, I don't believe that only ancient white Germans have something significant to say about the life of the church, and particularly not about the giftedness of women, because the patriarchal interpretive framework in which they worked, which forever subjugated women. I felt I needed to be interrogated and needed to be reconstructed. And so Southern was Southern gentility at its finest, highly patriarchal, highly hierarchical. And so my presence there, which exhilarated students, but it was seen as a little much in terms of the symbol system that had been going on since 1859. And when a new president had the opportunity to remove me, that happened. That's how I got to Central. And I have this deep sense that God preserved my vocation. I had some other options, but I thought, you know, why not go and strengthen, help cast my lot with an older school, help build capacity there, rather than be a part of a proliferation of multiple new schools, mm-hmm. which we can see some of the challenge of having done that in CBF life. And I thought as a matter of stewardship, it was a better move. And I wanted to get out of the southern, southeastern mm-hmm. orbit. I did not want to make a cottage industry out of having been fired. I really knew I had a lot more to do. I was 44 at the time. I had a lot more theological scholarship, teaching, leadership development to do.
Yeah. Just that story of your faithfulness to your call and your vocation and the doors that you were able to walk through, you know, for that calling is really inspiring. For our listeners, maybe younger women who are at the outset of their careers in ministry, is there any advice that you would venture to provide to them?
Oh, yes. And that is be really attentive to the deepest longings within you. What is stirring in you that you can get help discerning as a call from God? And do not be dissuaded by detractors. Because if you don't have detractors, you're probably not attempting something large enough, brave enough, courageous enough. Because the Holy Spirit always nudges us to transgress boundaries, always. There's always a transgression of some sort of an artificial boundary that the Spirit will move us beyond. I take a little bit of comfort from Paul's own narrative in 1 Corinthians 16, when he writes the fractious Corinthians and says, I'm going to stay where I am here in Ephesus. I know you want me to come, but I'm not going to do that. His self-differentiated answer is, I will remain here because a great door has opened unto me and there are many adversaries. Mm. And so within that text, I sense the dialectic of faithful ministry. There are always adversaries. There are always detractors. And young women who give too much credence to naysayers will find it hard to continue. I love the little novel by Gail Godwin, who discovers early in your ministry, you know something's your vocation if it keeps making more out of you. Now that's a line that I hold close to my heart and one that I would encourage other women, young men, to think about. It's your vocation. If it keeps calling you beyond where you are and requiring, summoning from you new strength, new competence, new courage, new faith, depth in prayer, that's a sign that you know it's your vocation if it keeps doing that.
Well, Molly, thank you for this beautiful conversation. Every time we talk, I learn so much, whether it be about Myanmar or vocation. And I'm just so grateful that you've listened to the Spirit's stirrings for so many years and for your long friendship with BJC.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to have you all on campus and to have this conversation, Amanda. I admire your work and the work of your team so very much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us today and listening to the BJC podcast. Take a moment to rate the BJC podcast on Apple Podcasts or share the BJC podcast however you listen to it via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or on our website. And as always, be sure to follow us on social media. For more from BJC, visit bjconline.org.